Houston, KPFT.org worldwide.
Aloha! In today's complex world, filled with complicated instructions like do this, turn here, don't staple, fold, spindle, tape, or mutilate, one way, etc., etc., why not take a break from all of this? Not near a seashore or relaxing in a tropical paradise.
Mike Koenig, my compatriot on engineering, is Egberto Willis. He has his own show Thursdays at 3 p.m., Politics Done Right. Here we do politics okay. And sometimes we don't do politics at all, but that's rare. Okay, well, I'm feeling uncommonly dry tonight. This is a concept I'm going to have to get used to. It's like I don't know what to do without 6 inches of water in the streets. Anyway, this is going to be open forum tonight. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. I'll throw out some thoughts that I'm having over the course of the week, and you can respond to those or come up with anything that's been on your mind or any kind of little bee in your bonnet, any burr in your saddle, whatever's been bugging you. Okay, so the first thing that I thought I would mention, apropos flooding, do you remember, I think it was a couple of years ago now, when we had that election for the pay-as-you-go flood control program? So pay-as-you-go essentially means that you don't go into debt, you don't buy bonds in order to do flood control work. The money has to be there first, and then you dedicate the money to the flood control issues. So, some of you folks that flooded last week, how do you feel now about pay-as-you-go flood control? This was a conservative-based issue. Now, conservatives are more interested typically in principles than outcomes, or outflows, as the case may have been last week. So here's the concept that I want to kind of flesh out. Bonds are so that you can borrow money to do a thing that gives you a value that you then pay back over time while you have the value. A home budget equivalent would simply be buying a house on a mortgage. Now, you can wait 30 years or maybe 20 years without interest to save up enough money to buy a house, but then you'll have not had the house for the 20 years. So you borrow the money, you pay interest, which is essentially a premium for the money you have borrowed. You buy your house, you have your house, you're paying your loan, but all the time you're paying the loan, you have your house. So we go back to flood control. This pay-as-you-go system means that we can't borrow money, which the city or the county would do by selling bonds. We can't borrow money in order to really do flood control because this initiative passed where we have to have the money in place first. So essentially, conservatives have forced the city and the county to live in an apartment for 20 years until they've saved up enough money to buy the house after the kids have already gone to college. The pay-as-you-go program means that instead of putting money into flood control now that will prevent property damage, that will prevent human misery, that will cut insurance rates, instead of doing that with borrowed money now, they would rather that we have to accumulate the money over the next 20 years, to just grab a number, while people in the meantime are flooding and losing their property and going through all kinds of misery and paying insurance premiums and having their insurance jacked up or in some cases discontinued. So thank you, conservatives, for pay as you go. Just a thought based on the flooding that I witnessed when I was going home last week with the cars flooded under underpasses where I was afraid people were drowning and the streets that were impassable. And, I mean, you guys were here, you know. Pay-as-you-go flood control. Drown while you're saving up the money. No problem. Open forum. 713-526-5738. And we do have open lines. I just can't see any of them because my monitor is down. So you're going to have to work with me a little bit here. Egberto's working with me a little bit here. But call. Okay. Let's see. Bernie Sanders is kind of interesting. So Bernie Sanders had to get kind of a special dispensation, like the equivalent almost of a papal dispensation, to run as in the Democratic primaries without actually changing his party affiliation and becoming a Democrat. So Bernie will tell you he's a Democratic socialist. He's a Democratic socialist. What's interesting is 50 years ago, his policies didn't sound that different from most Democrats and some Republicans. These days, he's considered pretty radical. So how do you feel about Bernie Sanders? Is he a spoiler? Is he a stalking horse in order to get Hillary to move further to the left? Is he simply a tool to excite some of the Democratic base to get them to turn out to vote in the primaries and the general? Is he there just for debate practice for Hillary to help her sharpen up her responses for the general? Is it possible that he'll become a vice presidential possibility? And what about, you see, I'm going to say Bert O'Malley, but I know that that's one of the guys at Baylor College of Medicine because I just know his name. But O'Malley from Maryland, who announced his run, and other folks. You see other folks because they're just not memorable. Do I have a caller, Egberto?
Line one, you have Mike, or rather, you have Bobby on line
one.
How
do we confuse Bobby and Mike? Bobby.
Hello?
Hey, Bobby, you're on the air. How you doing? What's on your mind?
Well, I'm hot, but not wet anymore.
But you're hot?
I'm hot.
Are you hot because I made you annoyed, or are you hot because you don't have power?
No, I'm hot because I'm cute. No, I'm kidding. It's the weather. The weather. It's global warming.
Egberto, he's adorable.
I've been outside moving. I make bad jokes also.
That's okay. I've been known to do those.
Okay. Now, there's several things. You started out with Bernie Sanders.
Actually, I started out with pay-as-you-go flood control, but we can talk about Bernie Sanders.
That's right. And so when people say that you can't have a deficit spending, any deficit spending, we got to get rid of the national debt, the deficit and everything, and pay as we go. We got to have gold in our pocket.
Right.
We can't. Okay. Now, can you imagine how much gold a millionaire, he would die from the weight of it? And the rest of us would run around saying, okay, I'm buying something at the dollar store. So which little flake of gold would you take for this bag of Cheerios? I mean, that's stupid.
Are you a coin collector, or have you ever known a coin collector?
Yeah, but
Have you ever seen gold coins from the 19th and early 20th century?
Yeah, they're very small.
A $5 gold piece was like a dime that had been shaved by 60%.
Yeah.
And that was at a rate of $18 an ounce.
Right.
So can you imagine gold coins? Literally, you'd be talking dust flakes.
180 ounces would be 1/1000th of a $5 gold piece. Right?
Say that again.
Okay. 100. Okay.
A one,
if it was $18 an ounce, 180 ounces would be like, well, actually, it'd be like 1/100th of a $5 gold piece.
You're talking about 180th of an ounce, I think, is what you're
right.
saying. Okay.
Okay, and a gram is only a 29th of an ounce, roughly. And so, okay, 60 times smaller than a gram, okay?
So what you could do is you could use gold nail polish and peel it off to pay for stuff.
Right. There's more gold in this phone I'm talking to you with than it would take to buy probably 5 pounds of garlic. I'm serious. How impractical is the gold standard? It's not practical. It's insane. And people who are doing that are selling gold stock. They're not selling gold. You don't get gold for their stock. These people are crazy. They say, well, you'll have inflation. But look, I have a Greek friend, a very smart guy. He's a doctor. He's a doctor. Okay. And he's older than me, and I'm 19 at least.
And
at least
I'm at least 19 also. I've been 19 three or four times by now.
I've been 19 for about,
I think it's more
years,
than three times
actually. Okay. The thing is, he told me about when the Peloponnesians and the Greeks and the Persians or somebody, the Greeks had the golden era in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be off a little bit. The idea is actually true, whether I'm off chronologically, don't argue, okay?
Okay.
But I know you won't, but okay. The Greeks decided that in Persia they had lots of gold, and they were just rich, rich, rich. And Greeks weren't in bad shape. So they go and attack Persia and steal their gold and junk. And within less than a generation, an ounce of barley, started costing ounces of gold. It was like crazy inflation. And they don't understand. People don't understand that gold inflates just like everything else. And so fight inflation by having gold. Okay, I'll tell you what. If I'm the only guy in town that has any gold, I'll have to spend it all just to survive and to pay people to protect me. There is no way that gold standard is going to work. That's why it was outlawed by people who gave us the protection. I can't remember the act that Republicans got rid of in order to cause the housing crisis, allow banks to, I can't remember the name of the act, but, So when you liberate banks, you debilitate society.
Well, the point that the gold standard people are making is that paper money is fiat money. It only has the value that the government assigns to it. It doesn't have any value that's intrinsic. But at the end of the day, that's true of all money, including precious metals.
But gold has only that value. It's true of gold.
Yeah.
See, it's intrinsic because, I can have a gold ring and it's valuable.
Right now, the price of gold is actually, the market value is actually higher than the price of platinum.
Platinum
right now is cheaper than gold, even though platinum is more precious. It's scarcer.
Right.
So, again, we're back to a perceived value, and that's,
exactly.
If Confederate money, if you still believed Confederate money was worth something and you could do a transaction with somebody who also believed that Confederate money was worth something, then Confederate money would actually be worth something.
That's right. Okay, here's the thing. See, gold has a perceived intrinsic value. It, as long as you use it as a precious metal, it is. It's that way. Now, but once you use it as common denominations, 20s, 10s, it loses that.
Well, there's also the question, and I'm going to let you go in just a minute, but there's also the question of if you have a currency based on a precious metal.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say on the first day of the month you mint a $100 gold coin.
Right.
But on the 15th day of the month, the gold in that coin is now worth $115.
Right.
Then what is that coin actually worth? Is it worth the face value or the melted value? So that's where you start to get, it starts to get
it'll
tricky, too.
It'll be worth the melted value because, Okay, you see, it just goes on and on. What they'll do is recycle it and make it into some other stuff. And so they'll take 15% and make another dollar. You see? I mean,
but, crazy. But it changes daily. Bobby.
It changes daily. And the other thing, the last thing I would like to say,
okay,
which makes it all round up and come back into a circle, is that iron is 4 cents a pound right now, scrap iron. Scrap iron is our most valuable commodity other than water or other than, let's say, aluminum. These should all be the standard. If you have, Jamaica should be outstandingly rich because they produce a lot of aluminum ore, you see, but they export it. They export it to the same corporations who were bailed out by the Wall Street bailout because the people in Jamaica who own the mine don't return the money to Jamaica. They put it in Wall Street. When Wall Street failed, the United States government bailed out Jamaican oligarchs.
Well, they needed someplace to go in the winter.
And all the dictators in the world were bailed out who owned stock.
All right,
you
Bobby,
see?
I'm going to have to let you go. I've got another caller waiting, but I appreciate it.
I know I've taken a lot of time, but we had fun, didn't we?
We did, and I appreciate your calling and do it again. You see, when you call early in the show, you get more time. Okay, take care, Bobby. I'll speak to you again.
Okay, Mike, we have Jerry that's up right now.
Jerry. Oh, and let me do a quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. My engineer is Egberto Willis, who's got his own show Mondays at 3 p.m., Politics Done Right. Jerry, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Yeah. I had to respond to a couple of things you said and also your last caller. The problem with the gold standard was, and this is what made everybody angry back in the progressive era and all that, was, you know, basically – you know, 1 year, basically an ounce of gold would buy you, you know, and this is just a made up example, but it basically holds true. You know, it would buy you a bushel of something, say, you know, corn or something like mm-hmm. that. Well, you know, 20 years later, you know, that same gold piece would buy you like 15 bushels of corn.
Because it doesn't increase in value proportionately to the commodities it purchases.
Right. The commodities, you know, if there's a big boom in commodities, basically, then, you know, then the amount of gold is set. You see what I'm saying? Then, you know, more or less, then, you know, you've got – and actually we didn't have lots of gold floating around. We had – you know, you can still go occasionally find in your money, you know, gold or silver notes.
Well, I think until the 1960s, the price of gold, as with currencies, the price of gold was fixed, and the government set the price. So I think back in the 19th century, the price of gold was like $16 or $18 an ounce. During the 1930s, I think when they outlawed Americans being permitted to own gold, I think that they set the price at like $35 or
$37
an ounce.
$35 an ounce, yeah.
And then in the 1960s.
They stayed at that for quite some time until we closed the gold window in the 70s, early
right.
70s.
Yeah, 60s or 70s. I think it was during a Nixon administration.
It was under Nixon, yeah, and I think it was like 71 or something like that.
Something like that. And then all of a sudden it's like, ka-chung, and the price just took off.
Well, that brings up another thing, too. Republicans and people on the right sit there and say sit there and complain about that, but of course it was a Republican who actually ended the gold.
Isn't that funny? And a Republican who put on wage and price controls. And a Republican who signed
right.
on the EPA.
Yeah, and then and all that. But what happened was, is you know, basically, you know, if you were a farmer, you could see where that would kill you financially.
Hmm. Okay.
All of a sudden, I got to produce 10 times more stuff. Or sell 10 times more stuff just to make my, you know, make my bills or whatever.
To get the same amount of gold you used to be able
right.
to get, yeah.
Bingo. And so you can see why that was such a hot burning issue back then. And all that. The closest the covenant countries ever come actually to going bankrupt was when we were under a gold standard, which is something most people don't really realize. Actually, J.P. Morgan made a deal with a bunch of British bankers, which saved the countries we're in. He basically acted as, in concert with them, as a lender of last resort to refill the gold coffers up to a point.
I don't think I recall learning about that. What was that, around 1900?
He got called into Congress on that.
Was that about 1900-ish?
Right after, yeah.
Okay.
No, Roosevelt wasn't president. There was somebody else. I'm trying to remember who it was. Roosevelt wasn't president. It might have been
like McKinley.
I think it was
Taft,
the guy after. I think it was Taft or something like that. It wasn't Theodore Roosevelt. You know, so they're sitting there, you know, and he's like, you know, basically, you know, the U.S. government didn't even realize there was actually a real problem. Actually, Morgan had to go to the president and say, look, you know, you're about to go broke, and here's why. And, you know, first time he went up there, the first time he talked to him about the problem, he basically got the door slammed in his face practically, even though he was J.P. Morgan. And then the second time they paid attention to him. But what happened was is he got called up in front of the congressional committee later, and he said, well, how did you get this gold, and what did you do with it, and how did you go about, you know, how did it, what was the exact nature of this transaction and all that?
I would respond to that, but I don't really have any knowledge of it.
I think, actually, I'm trying to think. I don't think it was Taft, because we did, I think, 1907,
isn't
when
it amazing
we start
how many,
the Federal Reserve. I think it was...
Isn't it amazing how many forgettable presidents we
yeah,
have?
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, but it was around that time. And like I said, the problem was is we didn't have enough gold over here. And...
So what happened? I mean, we mine a lot of gold. Was it just being sold overseas?
A lot of it was going overseas. Yeah. What happens is you know, basically, if you can, basically, we had gold valued. You could do a currency trade, what they call now, I think, the carry trade or something like that. Well, no, that I think that has to do with interest rates. But you know, basically, you know, in essence, a dollar would get, you know, a dollar was worth so much gold. And I don't remember the exact mechanics of it and everything, but, you know, basically there was a way in which it was profitable to drain money out of the country, basically. The British and the Europeans were basically draining money out of the U.S. slowly but surely,
well,
because they were making money doing it.
That I can address.
In their currency.
The United States, until the First World War, the United States was primarily an agricultural country. And most of the industry in the United States was owned by foreigners. So the United States was, until the First World War, a debtor nation. Essentially, most of our resources were foreign-owned, predominantly British-owned, I might add. And that was the nature of things. During the First World War, when the Allies had to buy a lot of equipment and a lot of industrial product, the United States, after the First World War, was the first time we became a creditor nation.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about, draining dollars from the United States, I mean, that's a very typical scenario for a country with a lot of foreign ownership.
Well, draining gold from the United States.
Well, because gold was a primary currency.
And everything. And all that. But
by the way, we are right now the largest debtor nation in the world. That's been
oh,
the
yeah,
case.
We are.
That's been the case since Reagan.
Yeah, and eventually we've got to equalize all that stuff.
Eventually we're going to have
to equalize
that.
How that goes down
will
be interesting
out.
To watch.
Yeah.
But, there's two sides to that story, but I don't want to go into it.
yeah, it might take 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, it takes the knowledge of economics that most people simply, you know, that they don't have and everything, and it becomes an accounting issue is what it boils down to.
You know, talking about that, and by the way, I will say we have open phone line 713-526-5738, and it is open forum, so you don't have to be talking about economics. But economics, even at my very lay level of understanding, economics is really, really interesting. People talk about an overabundance of currency causing inflation and a shortage of currency causing deflation. And when you have too much open productivity, unused productivity versus, you know, push and pull inflation. I mean, it's all this stuff is really, really interesting. And unfortunately, not enough people understand it, even at a lay level, to know
yeah.
there is this thing, and I don't understand the mechanics of this thing, but I need to know that this thing is part of the process, and it affects my life and my country and our politics. And people don't even have enough knowledge of that to dispute the garbage that they hear.
Well, I'll tell you what, one of the patron saints of conservatives, old David Hume, actually wrote a famous essay on the balance of trade. in which he discussed that, and he sat there and said, you know, basically, what happens if all the money gets drained out of our country? You know, would that be the end of the world? And he sits there and goes, no, because we would still be have our manufacturers, you know, we would still have, you know, our coal mines, you know, our farms, our people, you know, and yada, yada, all the things that would make, you know, all the things that actually make real wealth, and all that money would come back to us.
When was that written, do you know? Approximately within a decade or so. The reason I'm asking is because you made a very interesting point.
1760, I guess. That'd be about right, I guess.
Okay, then that's why he's wrong. Because what happened during the 1930s when we had a depression was we had food rotting in the field that no one could afford to buy. We had factories that were idle because they were making stuff that nobody could afford to buy because there was just no money being exchanged. So having the assets, having the assets is a good thing, but just because you have the assets, it doesn't automatically mean they can produce wealth.
Basically, the money has to circulate.
Yes.
You know, you have to actually spend the money. The money has to move from hand to hand.
And it's important to understand what money is. Money is simply a store of value. You don't have a car.
Or a medium of exchange.
It's a medium of exchange because it is a store of value. Otherwise, you couldn't exchange it for anything.
Yeah.
So when people don't have a way to store value, then they're reduced to bartering, which is much, much less efficient.
Yeah, and you know what? Actually, you got talking earlier, actually, that's what like libertarians do, the ones that want to go back to a gold system. That's what they do. They have little bits of gold that they sell you. You know, you can like, you know, you, of course, you spend your cash.
Yeah, they'll take your cash in exchange for this gold.
Of course, with greenbacks, which, of course, you know, presents interesting issues in heaven by itself at the very beginning of the whole thing.
We'll take your worthless paper money in order to sell you our
right,
precious
gold. Right, yeah, then, if you want to deal with us on this, in this, you know, with our little group, then you've got to buy this little bit of gold and everything. And we only want greenbacks, by the way.
Yeah, this worthless stuff on paper.
The reality is, if we went to that, what would happen is if we went to a gold standard, in fact, what we would do is we would go back much more to a barter system.
Essentially, yeah.
And everything, yeah. And,
because now you'd start weighing the coins to see how much gold is in them to see what today's value is. I mean,
say that again.
You would end up weighing the gold coins to see how much weight was in them. People would start going back to seeing if the edges were shaved. They would start biting on them to see if they were soft enough to be gold. They would be weighing them to see what today's value
is. Well, and most people
is.
Don't know that stuff.
Yeah. Well,
and everything. And I mean, there's ways to check. You know, there's all kinds of ways to check whether or not, whether, you know, you're getting gold or real silver, but you got to know a few things.
Yes.
And everything. And, you know, I've seen silver bars. I had a job one time where I actually dealt with stuff like that, and I've seen silver bars that were, you know, filled up with lead, and they made them look like they'd never been touched. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can really fake stuff.
Yeah.
People don't realize this. You know, everybody sits there and goes, well, it's as good as gold. Well, really, is it?
And is it really gold?
Yeah, is it even really gold? How do you know for sure?
And gold is only as good as the perception of it is.
You know, for that matter, because like I said, actually the case I'm thinking about specifically was a big silver bar.
Right.
And everything, and it was filled, you know, half of the weight, though, was lead, which was worth, you know, quite a bit less than all the silver it replaced.
Well, one of the stories that I've told is during the Roman Empire, at a time when black pepper was literally worth more than its weight in gold, one of the ways merchants would cheat customers is they would put in some powdered lead, which obviously was a lot cheaper than pepper, but it looked like pepper. And then you end up with a lot of lead poisoning within the empire. It's very complicated stuff. But yeah, people always find a way to cheat, and you always have to try to find ways. It's almost like cyber crime before cyber. We have somebody else on the line. So I appreciate your calling. It's been an interesting conversation. I hope you'll call back, Jerry.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks.
All right, take care. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. The quarter hours seem to be passing for me fairly quickly.
We have GERPA.
GERPA.
G-E-R-C-H-A.
G-E-R-C-H-A. Gercha?
G- Good time. Yeah, I'm Kurt, got it.
Okay.
But it's like Big Bertha with the G, with the letter G. It's
ah, Gertha. Okay, I got that. Gertha, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
You started out with talking about the flooding in Houston and in Texas.
Yes.
And I have been campaigning for people to protest their property values this year. But I think next year it'll be even better because now everybody's value has gone down. With eight.
Thank God for flooding. It'll save us some taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you see, we're just looking at it wrong. You have to see the silver lining, which may, in fact, just be silver-plated lead.
Yeah. So
in every disaster, at least our property taxes will go down now.
Yeah, if everybody protests. So I'm campaigning.
Everybody should protest.
I've had my individual protests going on for the last week or so with posters in the window saying, protest your property taxes.
You know what? I'm going to say something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Everybody should be prepared to protest their taxes. But for a lot of people, the process is very intimidating, very overwhelming. But you know what? There are lawyers and law firms out there that specialize in tax protest. Mm-hmm. Now, usually the fee, if you get the right guy, the fee is usually half of what they save you the first year. So it really, if you wouldn't have protested your taxes at all, paying them half of what the increase would have been and saving the other half is a pretty good deal. Plus, you end up saving the tax, that same tax break year after year, because these things tend to accrue. So if you're not up for protesting taxes yourself, I absolutely recommend finding a real estate tax law firm that can do the protest for you and make sure that you just get the right deal. But that's better than not doing anything.
Yes, because I've learned that you are really appraising the property yourself, because you know what's wrong, what's devaluing your property, and you take it to the appraisal district, which, you know, like you said, most people are intimidated by that. But I think we should learn to appreciate it, that we should talk about it more, that we should discuss it more, you know, and bring it out more in the community so that people will feel like, hey, this is just like filling out taxes towards the Internal Revenue Service.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you know if your roof is near the end of its useful life. You know if your foundation needs work, or you know if you have a high traffic location that reduces the potential value of your property. And when you share this with HCAD, the Houston, the Harris County Appraisal District, they will very often give you a reduction based on those things.
Because they don't know. We have to correct them. We have to tax assess the collector's office to come out. They say you should protest your taxes every year. I talked to a guy that was 91 years old. He said, oh, yes, I protest my taxes every year.
So he's protested his taxes at least 70 times.
Really? Oh, he very proudly told me that he protests every year. And this is, but this is what the county told us at one of the meetings we had about 10 years ago. They said you should protest your taxes every year because they don't know. The only way they know is that you come to them and show them what the problem is and what the correction is, because they only use a computerized system to, you know, value land. They're not going from door to door, street to street, checking it. And then I'm going to stop there on the protesting.
Well, I want to make one more comment on that, because the point you made when you started, which was flooding will reduce property values, it's really important to know that when you sell a property, you have to make disclosures. You are legally required to make these disclosures, because if you don't disclose something that is a fact, you can be accused of fraud. It's a criminal offense.
Okay.
So once your house has flooded, and I've seen this on property disclosure forms, one of the things it will say is, has there ever been rising water on your property? Has it ever entered your house? Have you ever made an insurance claim? Have you ever made an insurance claim for flood damage? All of these different things. So in a real sense, once water has entered your house and you have to make that disclosure if you want to sell it, you're going to lose potential buyers, which essentially reduces the value of your home. So that's a real thing.
Okay. So I'm waiting, you know, for the watching the rain and watching the ditches. I live in Acres Home. So that's our drainage systems are open ditches. The city does not keep maintenance on the ditches. We were under Harris County.
Harris County Flood Control District, yes.
When we were under Harris County, 30 years before we annexed to the city, that was done, you know, throughout our childhood and the mosquito control. That was automatic. The county did this. The ditches were so clean and kept so well that we could play in them, you know, in dry seasons and no problem.
But I think that the city was so much smaller and the population was so much lower, and runoff was not as much of a problem, because the more development you have, the bigger problem you have with runoff rather than absorption.
Okay.
So, I mean, things have physically changed in the metropolitan area.
They have. But why should the citizens have to call 311 to dig out your ditch?
So if I because nobody wants to pay the taxes necessary for the city to do its job. So the squeaky wheels get the grease.
So is it possible, you think, for the county to take over just the ditches, maintaining the ditches, the drainage system?
I don't think it's ever a matter of either or. Essentially, the county has to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Yeah.
So they can't just be responsible for ditches, just like they can't just be responsible for roads and just be responsible for building inspections. You know, we need to pay enough tax money to get the services that we both need and want. I mean, if we don't want a benefit from government, we don't have to pay for it. But there are things we need, and flood control is a thing we need. I mean, that's like, it's not optional. Flood control is not optional because the alternative is flooding. Okay. Have we exhausted our topic of conversation, Gertha?
Well, I guess maybe we have. It's just that I was just wondering, should the system of getting the ditches cleaned or corrected be on the 311 system? Seems like that would just be maintenance that the city does. Anyway.
Well, the 311 system is not supposed to be for the responsibility of cleaning ditches. The 311.
Well, it is.
No. The 311 system is supposed to be a way for citizens to report that something has not been properly done or has not been done in a reasonable amount of time. Essentially, it's a way that you can complain that the city will hear you. But there's supposed to be a routine for going around at various times in a decade or a year in order to do certain tasks. So roads are supposed to be rebuilt every so often. Ditches are supposed to be cleared every so often, just like garbage is supposed to be picked up every so often.
Okay, but it isn't.
Well, that's why you have a 311 system, but that's also because we don't have the tax revenue to do the jobs that need to be done without people complaining that they haven't been done.
So what do we need to do in order to get this done systematically every 5 years, 10 years, whatever, it's like 30 years they haven't done this?
We need to have a system that assesses enough taxes in a progressive manner so that our institutions have the resources they need to do the things that we need to have done. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to money. You have to have the money to do the things you want to do. If you don't have the money, you don't do them.
So what do we need to do?
We need to tax people, and we need to do it progressively.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, one of my bete noirs is toll roads.
Mm-hmm.
Toll roads are basically a form of regressive taxation in order to get from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what if we had toll roads on every street? What if to pull your car out of your driveway onto the street, you had to pay a toll? And then to get on to 610, you had to pay another toll. And then to get on to 288, you had to pay another toll. In theory, that's what a lot of conservatives at the extreme would like, because they believe in user fees. If you can't afford to pay for it, you shouldn't use it. So toll roads are essentially a form of discrimination against the poor. You can only use that road if you can afford it. Whereas my philosophy is, if a road benefits the community should be able to use it, and there should be tax revenue to pay for it. Okay, I think we're probably beating this dead horse. So I'm going to let you go, Gertha, and I appreciate your calling and hope you'll call back.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right, have a good night. Okay, we have open lines. The number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. And you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and my compatriot Egberto Willis on engineering. Rand Paul. Rand Paul is an interesting character. I don't dislike Rand Paul. I certainly disagree with him on almost every issue. I don't think he's a stupid guy, but I don't think that he'll blow any circuits with the intellectual power that exudes from him. I think his ideas are simplistic. But, you know, I give him credit for actually standing up for stuff he rightly or wrongly believes. So he has been ticking off a whole lot of Republicans by placing roadblocks in front of the renewal of the Patriot Act. Now, whether you agree with the Patriot Act or not, whether you agree with certain aspects of it or not, the process of what's been going on in the Senate around the Patriot Act is really, really interesting. So, for example, there's this one story that was on Politico entitled "Senators Flash Anger at Paul and Vice Versa." Senator Coates of Indiana, McCain of Arizona refused to yield the floor to Rand Paul, who has promised to force a sunset of key parts of the national security law. And the spat, this is I'm reading now, the spat prompted a terse back and forth during a rare Sunday session prompted by Paul's refusal earlier to allow votes on the issue. McCain sniped that Paul needs to learn the rules of the Senate. And apparently there was a situation where Rand Paul wanted to make comments on the Senate floor, but the people that have the floor at that moment have to yield that time for him to speak. And they just refused to yield the time. So he kept trying to interrupt the discussion on the floor, and they kept saying, no, I will not yield time to the senator. I will not yield time to the senator. And apparently afterward, Coates of Indiana, who had been lamenting, quote, lies told about the NSA by, quote, unnamed members of the Senate, walked over to Ron Paul and said he wasn't trying to silence the senator. But Paul apparently was really annoyed and just basically blew off Coates with a wave of the hand and what someone heard as whatever, whatever. So this stuff is getting a little personal. McCain apparently watched with a chuckle because, you know, he's kind of a vindictive guy. So he was getting some pleasure out of that. Open line, 713-526-5738. I have links to that article on my website, by the way, thinkwingradio.com. Most of the stuff I talk about comes from articles, and usually I'll post links to the articles so that you can see what it is that I'm basing my comments on. Apparently, Rand Paul has gotten a lot of Republicans really mad at him. So an internecine sort of battle is going to be going on here philosophically within the party. This brings up actually an article that I ran across a couple of weeks ago that I've kind of hung on to but not really brought up specifically. It was in U.S. News and World Report called "Is There Room for a Third Party?" Now, I've made my feelings about this known. I don't have any objection in principle to a third party, but I don't want to see a third party until it's necessary for a winner to get 50% plus one of the votes. I don't like the notion that somebody can win an election, like a three- or four-way election, with 35 or 42 or 39% of the vote. That's happened in Maine a couple of times, where they have this guy, Paul LePage, who has managed to be elected and reelected because he was in a three- or four-way race, and he got a plurality of the vote, like 37 or 39%.
It's deeper than that. I mean, right now, the most prolific person, the most prolific Democrat that has ever won over 50% by a substantial margin has been Barack Obama. The reality is President Clinton, the first time he ran,
like
came
43%.
Under 40-something percent, and the second time he ran, under 50% as well.
Well, I think the first time he ran, wasn't it a four-way race?
It was a three. I mean, it's always more than a three-way.
No, but I mean, I think you had John Anderson.
You had Perry. The guy from Dallas.
Yeah.
You know who we mean.
All of a sudden, I can't think of the name. Isn't that crazy? And then you had Bush.
It wasn't Bush. The first time was Bush,
The first time was Bush, and Clinton.
Right.
And
he won with under like 46% or something like that.
And in a non-parliamentary system, that is simply not a good way to win. It's not a good form of representative government. I think that it allows people to argue, and with some justification, that there is not a mandate for this person. It makes them politically weak. So on the other hand, you know, when you talk about a third party, I think a great example is the Republican Party and the evolution of the Republican Party over like the last 50 or 60 years. People are always talking about how much more conservative the Republican Party is than it used to be. It didn't take a third party to suddenly become more conservative. The fact is that there are two aspects to a party: the people that are activists in it and the people that vote for it. So a party changes. The Democrats used to be the racist party. The Republicans used to be the anti-slavery civil rights party, but different people became active in the parties, and then different people began voting for the parties, and the parties became something else.
But we need more than two. We really do.
Only if we can get a 50% mandatory winning margin.
Not really. I mean, the thing about it is if we have more than two parties, Congress will be made up of different people as well.
Yeah, but it's not a parliamentary system. Okay, anyway, we have a couple of callers on, and now we're getting toward the last quarter of the show, so I want to get them on the air. Who's the first one?
Okay, the first one is going to be Danny.
Danny. Hey, Danny, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Thank you for sharing the idea and the opinions on the radio. I appreciate it, gentlemen.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad
I heard you were talking about with the other gentleman about the information about taxing on the street and the highway and all that. Mm-hmm. That's right?
Yes, we're talking about toll roads and highway taxes and such.
Well, I lived here a very long time. I'm a Houstonian. I'm from Texas. Texas and Houston is a beautiful city, beautiful state. I speak for the good people, nice people. People that live here for a long time. I don't know about you gentlemen, how long you live here. Or you came from New York or Colorado or California. I don't know. But you should do something nice to the people in the city of Houston and Texas. We are beautiful people. We should be living in very heaven cities and all that. Shouldn't be taxed and punishing people like us.
Okay, well, you say you don't want to be taxed, but who's going to pay for the stuff you want? Who's going to pay for your roads? Who's going to pay for your storm sewers? Who's going to pay for your flood control? Who's going to pay for your cops? Who's going to pay for your schools? Who's going to pay for your firemen?
Before you were talking about this, we've been living like this. We've been living in the city of Houston for 100 years. Nothing had ever done or interfering.
Well, I mean,
up on the radio, you're interfering with the people.
We could go back to dirt and gravel roads. We could go back to, you know, having street cleaners pick up horse poo.
I'm afraid you gentlemen from New York or something.
I am from New York. I don't apologize for that.
You should go back to New York.
Well,
living here in Texas.
What is your? Where are you from originally, sir? Where's your family from?
I'm from here.
No, you're not. Your family is from someplace else. Where is your family from?
Well, I just talking to you like that. But
well,
I'm
no, you're
here.
Saying I should go back to New York. I'm wondering where you should go back to.
Well, we live here very nicely. We like Houston.
I've been here for over half my life. So, thank you. That's okay. You didn't have a valid point of discussion anyway. Okay, who's next online there, Egberto? We got two more callers on the line, but Egberto is otherwise occupied, and I don't have a screen here.
Well, you don't have a screen because, you know, we're having tech difficulties, but now you have Tim, my dear friend.
Okay, Tim.
Yes, sir.
You're on the air, and I hope you're not going to tell me to go back to New York.
Well, I mean, you may if you wish, but I'm not telling you to, okay?
I've been here since 1977, and in spite of the fact I don't agree with all the politics, apparently I've voted with my feet and my butt.
Well, hey, I've been here since 64, so there you go.
There you go.
And I, you know, I was born in Chicago, so maybe I should go back to the Windy City.
Well, you know, everyone is from somewhere. And we can all say you should go back to wherever you're from or your parents are from or your grandparents are from, and that's just not a useful topic of conversation.
Well, absolutely. You know, ridiculous. But I am interested in the tax thing, drainage, taking care of the business of the city. And, you know, quite frankly, last Monday when things got all haywire in the city because it was saturated and we had all the rain, my in-laws live over near Memorial Park in one of the last remaining little ramshackle single-story dwellings in amongst all these towering townhouses. Mm. And they've lived there for almost 40 years. And for the first time in that 40 years, we had a running creek of a street.
Wow.
In 40 years. Now, the point of this is that what you said a moment ago about the dynamic, you didn't use the word dynamics, but that is my word. The dynamics have changed for our drainage. We have not the land to absorb anymore.
Right.
So it all has to go somewhere, and guess where it's going to go? It's going to go to the nearest open channel.
Well, actually, Anise Parker was being interviewed on TV, and she made the point that the city's flood control strategy partly is the streets are part of our runoff system.
Well, that's all well and good, except hard to navigate and people die. You know, because, and quite frankly, I do not understand why anyone would drive into an underpass. I don't care how much water it has or doesn't have. Why you would do that in these conditions and then you end up dead. I don't understand that, but that's not why I called.
Okay.
What I called about is we pay 8.25 sales tax.
Right, which is
I pay another $1.75, 1.75, whatever it is, 0.175 cents. Easy. Think about the millions of people here. Increase it to 10%, and there would be a whole lot of money in the city coffers.
But here's the thing about sales tax. It's a regressive flat tax. The multimillionaire pays the same amount on a purchase that someone at the poverty level pays. It is a regressive tax.
I get that, but at least it would be something that wouldn't tax the hell out of the little guy.
Well,
you know, because we could all afford to pay a dime for a dollar purchase.
Yeah, you know, if it's only a dime on a dollar purchase, that's fine. But what if it becomes $10 on a $100 purchase or $50 on a $500 purchase?
If you can afford to buy a $100 item, you got another 10 bucks.
But it's regressive. It punishes poor people.
Because I'm not well-versed in how this all works. I'm just saying that would be one immediate small solution. I understand it would be a small solution.
Okay, I'll take it as it's intended then. What we're agreeing on is that taxes are worth the things that we need our government to do.
Well, yes, absolutely. You can't get what you don't contribute to.
So at that point, it's just a matter of details.
Yeah.
So we're agreeing on the premise, which matters.
Then you figure out the details. But I do believe 100% that unless someone does, if Anise Parker thinks that our streets are our new flood control, they need to rethink development and how it is done and how the drainage from those properties is done.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Tim, I'm going to have to let you go because we're running out of time, and I'd like to get everybody on the air.
I made the 2 points I wanted to make.
I appreciate your call and call back. Take care. Have a good night. Okay.
Okay, we have our last call, Jack.
Jack.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Jack. How are you? You're on the air.
I'm good. And I want to make sure that everybody knows KPFT is a terrific station.
Oh, we appreciate that.
And the the good people that they get, you guys volunteer to come out here to do this on KPFT and talk to the people that need to be talked to. I salute that. I honor that. Let me tell you, my prayers are with you all the time.
Well, thank you very much, because we can use all the help we can get.
Including
donations. Don't forget, you can go into the tip jar at kpft.org. I just have to throw that out there.
Yeah, there we go. Let's throw some stuff around for a minute.
Yes.
The one thing I wanted to mention, that all, you know, people call and they got this and that. I don't know where they're airing their, what they refer to, dirty laundry or whatever. But let's try to go to the bottom line as quickly as possible.
Okay.
A lot of these people, I don't know if they're just talking because they want to hear themselves rattle or what. But the bottom line is, we're all in this together, and we need to make solutions that include all of us together.
You know, one of the things that I've said for many, many years is that we are in a country that is like sports crazy.
Oh, that's...
And yet, even though we all, like, support our team, you know, it's like our football team, our baseball team, our basketball team. What about our national team? Can't we see our country as we're all on the same team and we're only as good as our weakest players, and we can gain the most advantage by giving our weakest players as much help as we can get?
That's right.
So
everybody in the boat has a job.
We're all on the American team. We're all Team America.
There you go. And I honor the garbage man to come out and pick up the damn cat litter, even though as nasty as a job as that sounds, he's doing his job.
And it's an essential job, and a lot of people look down on that person, but, hell, we would all notice if he wasn't there in a hurry.
There you go. It's the same way for every one of us. So I think if we would regard that more highly, more valuable, that we all have, importance, you know, in running this boat. So,
every job matters, and, you know, some jobs are less skilled and some jobs are less paid. But I'll tell you what, there is hardly a job that anybody does that you wouldn't notice if they didn't show up.
Well, there you go. You know, it's the same thing for even, like my body. I cut my thumb the other day, and now I'm doing tasks and stuff around the house, and I'm always hurting the thing. I'm going, damn, I need that part of my thumb.
Okay, now, you mentioned that. I have to tell you something I have seen on TV all the time. You watch a lot of these dramas where, like, you know, they have to give blood for a spell, or they have to do, like a blood brother thing where they're sharing blood. Why are they always slicing down the middle of their hand? That's like the most painful thing that disables you. Why don't they just, like, prick by the top of their lower arm or something?
Well, let's take an example from the normal sugar diabetes person.
Yeah, I don't, you know, when I do a blood sugar sample, I don't do the fingertip, man. That's just a bad idea. There's blood all over. I'm just going to take it from someplace else. All right, Jack, I'm hearing music, so we got to get ready to go.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. My engineer has been at Beardo Willie's, and we've had some fun tonight. But we're not going home. We're staying right here, sort of metaphorically. All right, everybody, have a great week. And remember, vote. There are primaries coming up. If your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't be trying so hard to suppress it. Take care.
Local election supervisor to oversee the listener and staff elections at your local station. If you or someone you know is interested in this position, you can view the detailed job description at elections.pacifica.org. To apply via email, send a cover letter, your resume, and 3 references to the attention of the National Election Supervisor to NES@pacifica.org. For more information about the upcoming local station board elections, see the election calendar, and sign up for periodic updates, visit the elections website at elections.pacifica.org.
This is KPFT Houston 90.1 FM.
Why donate your car to KPFT? You can free up space in your garage, you can avoid the hassles of selling your car, there's no need to pay hefty car repair bills, and you turn that unwanted car into an IRS tax deduction. In addition, you're helping to make the Houston area better with unique arts, music, and culture. You help keep options on the airwaves. Best of all, making a car donation is easy and always free. Just call 1-855-573-8227 or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Again, that number is 1-855-KPFT-CAR. Thanks for your help. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.